Welcome to the Connect Kindness podcast, where we connect people with organizations to inspire kindness. I'm your host, Crystal Aziz, and I'm joined by my co-host, Tim Evans. In today's episode, we interview Kathy Hine, the founder of the Lyft Garage. Imagine a homeless person who lives in their car or the families that can barely put food on their table. Have you ever wondered who fixes their cars when they need it? The Lyft Garage is the answer.
Kathy and her team aim to move people out of poverty and homelessness by providing low-cost car repair, free pre-purchase car inspection, and honest advice that supports their community on the road to more secure lives. In our interview, Kathy shares with us what led her to start the organization. We discuss some of the challenges that her team faces on a daily basis, and we learn about their plan for the future to help positively impact more and more lives. So without further delay, this is our interview with Kathy Hying, the founder of the Lyft Garage.
Thank you so much for joining us on the Connect Kindness podcast. Kathy, can you share with our listeners, what is the Lyft Garage and what needs do you guys serve?
Thank you so much for having me. The Lyft Garage is a nonprofit auto repair shop. We are based in Minneapolis, Minnesota, and we provide low-cost car repair for low-income Minnesotans. We also provide free pre-purchase inspections. So if folks who are looking to buy a car need advice or want that inspected before they buy it, we will do that for free. And then we also provide a mobile van service that helps, goes out to people's homes and mostly helps assess their cars about whether it's worth investing in or not. So those are kind of the three arms of our program.
Kathy, one of my favorite things is asking the backstory. I love to hear the story of kind of where the idea came from. So can you just give us that story where the inspiration comes from to where you dedicated your life to giving back?
I have known since I was a young kid that I wanted to live a life of service. And I don't remember any specific instance that turned me in that direction. But for as long as I can remember, I wanted to be a social worker. And so even though I wasn't always sure exactly what that meant, but that was the best term I had for it. And so I often, sort of kept looking in that direction for how to shape my life. I grew up in a house where service and acceptance was a given. I have my oldest brother has Down syndrome, and my parents, I grew up in a small town in Iowa, and there were no resources for kids with special needs or parents with special needs in 1956 in a town of 800 people in Northeast Iowa, in a time when we did not have a very good understanding of developmental disabilities in the ways we do now. So my parents were advised multiple times to put my brother in an institution and people kept saying to my mom, "You're young." She was only 19 when she had him. "You're young, you can still have plenty of kids, sort of just forget this ever happened and move on." That is not the people my parents were. And so they chose to raise my brother at home. But again, they didn't know anything about raising children. He was their first, much less kids with special needs, and there were just no resources. And so they would never describe themselves this way, but they became pretty active disability rights folks. But mostly it was like they wanted what any other parent would want for their child, which is the best resources, access, whether it was church stuff, school stuff, social stuff. So from a very young age, I had role models that said, we're gonna work to make things better for whomever is in need. I also had this very strong sense, because I spent a lot of time in group homes or other places with my brother, that so I was very accustomed to being with people who were very, very different, and that was just a given that is how we are in the world. So I feel like those things really laid the foundation for how I see the world and how I see my role in the world. Fast forward a lot of years later, I had a degree in social work, a master's in pastoral ministry. I was doing church work primarily at the time, and just kept encountering folks for whom a car repair was a make or break deal in terms of the success of the other parts of their lives. So they They can't get their car fixed. They can't get to their job. They lose their job, can't pay the rent. Now they're experiencing homelessness. There's this spiral downward. Or conversely, the church I worked for ran a shelter for single adult men. And I saw lots of guys for whom not having access to reliable transportation sort of kept them there. You know, the jobs were all out in the suburbs, a 2.5 hour bus ride away one way. You know, you're sleeping in a room full of 40 other guys. You're not sleeping well. You know, to get up at 4 in the morning to catch 3 buses to be at work by 6:30. It was not a sustainable thing. So just I became really aware of how vital a safe and reliable car was in terms of people's success at staying out of poverty or moving out of poverty. And that's sort of what was the impetus for the idea of the Lyft Garage.
Thank you for sharing that, you know, personal story. And then, you know, you see it full circle now evolving into your adult life. And, you know, because you're exposed to so much empathy and so much different perspective than everybody else in your generation, now look at the great things that you're doing, you know, for everybody else in this generation. So that's so amazing. Your nonprofit is unique. I've said this, I like to say it when we feature a nonprofit that we've never been exposed to before. So I have not heard of another mechanic shop doing this or helping, you know, people in need in this way. So how did that form? What steps did you need to take to get to where you're at right now?
Sure. Great question. A lot. I knew nothing about cars, as I mentioned previously, and my background was in social work and ministry. I always like to joke that I, you know, just wanted to use my ministry background to drive demons, do exorcisms on cars, you know, and just, you know, we'll holy water sprinkling and, you know, merge the two. But so I knew nothing about cars, but I just kept seeing these situations and encountering folks who had this need. And in particular, there was a program at the time here in the Twin Cities that was doing this on a part-time basis. And they were charging less than market rate, but not, I mean, it was still like $50 an hour, which is way less than market rate. But I remember distinctly having a conversation with one of the guys in the shelter. He's like, I get general assistance, which is a program that the state of Minnesota offers for single adults, but it's $203 a month. And he's like, $50 an hour. That's like $1 million to me. I mean, that's 1 hour is 25% of my monthly income. And so like, I really need help at a even more affordable rate. And so that it was sort of all those pieces that I just kept swimming about. And I just kept thinking the phrase, and I joke about it a lot now, but I like, jeepers, somebody should do something about this. You know, we really, you know, I don't know why somebody isn't doing something about this. And then one day it dawned on me that like, oh, that somebody might be me. And so I like to joke that if you find yourself repeatedly thinking that phrase, somebody should be doing something about this, like you should just set down whatever you're doing and turn around and run, because it's probably the universe tapping you on the shoulder to say you're the one and you're in for a lot of work and a big ride. But I don't regret it at all. But so I started with going to school because I didn't know anything about cars, and I didn't really envision exactly what the Lyft Garage is now. I think probably out of self-preservation. Like if you'd have said, you're going to go back to school, you're going to learn a new trade, you're going to open a nonprofit, you're going to, you know, I would have been like, no, too much work. But I thought, well, maybe I can, you know, do some work in my driveway on the weekends or, you know, something like that. But I needed to learn the trade. So I sort of reluctantly enrolled in automotive school. I say reluctantly because I didn't, I was still paying off my grad school student loans. I loved the life I had. I didn't really have a huge desire to go to tech school with 40, 18-year-old boys. I was 38 at the time. And I, yeah, but I just, the idea or the need would not leave me. And I just came to a conclusion that I would regret it more if I didn't try than if I tried and failed. So I enrolled in automotive school. It's a full-time 2-year program. And got an associate's degree in auto technology. And then it was, now what, and so I spent a few years having conversations with a lot of different kinds of folks, people who, city council folks, people who own garages, people who've run nonprofits, people who work in garages, anybody that I thought might have some useful information that I could talk to. And ultimately it just started emerging that really what we need is a full-time nonprofit dedicated to this. So then the groundwork work, started shifting more in that direction. So I got a group of volunteers to serve as a board in 2011, excuse me. And in 2012, we got our 501c3 status. And in 2013, we opened our doors. So,
I mean, you answered the calling. Right. I mean, that is like you heard it. And I think a lot of people out there hear it, but they may not act on it. So that's fantastic. And, we're doing this interview over Skype, Zoom. And even though it's just audio, I'm looking and I see CNN Heroes behind you. Can you explain what is that? And how did you get that?
Yeah, in 2015. So I don't know if they actually don't even know if they still do it, but for a number of years, CNN had a program that they called CNN Heroes, and they would feature about 25 people from across the country that they would designate as a CNN hero, and they would do a recording segment, come and film. They came. I'm always amazed at the industry of television, because they came and shot footage and interviews for 14 hours for a 90-second clip. So then it aired like multiple times. They just repeated it multiple times over, I think, a weekend. And then the program was, they narrowed it down to 10, and then they selected one person to get like a $25,000 grant or whatever. I didn't make the top 10, and that was just fine. But the exposure from being named one of their heroes and that national exposure just really was amazing in terms of fundraising and attention that it got for the Lyft. It really just catapulted us to another level in terms of capacity and awareness about our work. So
that is really cool. Congratulations.
I'm a little disappointed that you didn't mention the golden vice grips. That's on
I
the
can't,
other.
I can't. Yeah, what's the golden vice grip? I can't read that.
Irwin Tools named me their tradesperson of the year. And that was also 2015. So it came with the golden vice grips, and I'm very, just in case your listeners are wondering, it does work. I have removed it from the plaque and actually used it on something just because I had to know.
That is too cool. I'd love to get, kind of into the nitty gritty and how many cars are you guys able to fix in a month? And also, what does the demand look like for people who need their cars fixed?
When we started, we were in 2013, we sublet a bay one day a week. We were fixing about 2 cars a week. So, kind of one in the morning and one in the afternoon on every Saturday. Now, next month in April, will be 8 years that we'll be open. We now have our own building with 5 bays, a staff of 12, including 5 full-time auto technicians. We see about 120 cars a month. We actually repair around 70, 75 of them. So the others are sort of a mix. We see about probably 20 to 30 cars in any given month we conclude are not worth investing in. we conclude that in conversation with the owner. Because often one of the driving factors for us is rust. Here in Minnesota, we have to salt the roads to keep the ice away in the winter, and that salt can eat away at the underbody of your car. So there are times when a car looks great on top, and then we get it up on a lift and, you know, the entire subframe is rusted, and, you know, one small fender bender in that car is, you know, a serious problem. And so about 20 to 30 of those cars end up, we calling them do not invest DNIs. And then the rest are estimates only. People come and they get the estimate. We give them a full assessment of their car, and then they on their own choose not to do the work or choose to come back at a later date and do the work. And then, like I said, we have a mobile van. So we see probably about 12 to 15 people a week in our mobile van. And then we probably do 4 or 5 pre-purchase inspections a month, about 1 a week maybe. So even despite that massive growth from kind of 6 or 8 cars a month to 130 cars a month in 8 years, we cannot remotely keep up with the demand. We are typically booked out about 3 to 4 months worth of appointments, which is troublesome for us because, you know, in the beginning when I talked about the person who can't get to their job because their car's broken down, we're not really being helpful to that person because we can't respond to immediate needs. And unfortunately, many car repairs are immediate needs. So that is an issue that we continue to try to deal with. And I cannot tell you how many times we have switched up how we schedule, the types of appointments we'll take, you know, just trying all sorts of things on. And it so far, nothing has been kind of the magic formula. Excuse me. We just are in the middle of trying yet another new way of doing it. And instead of just scheduling out to the next available, whenever that happened to be, we're now only scheduling a month at a time. So on the second Monday of the month. So as we are recording this, it is early March. On March 8th, our schedule will open for the month of April. So with the hope being that those folks who might have a more immediate need might have a better shot at getting in sooner. We don't have enough data yet to say like how fast appointments are filling up. I mean, this is a really new model for us. So we're still in the learning and data gathering stage, but we're really, again, trying to be creative with how we respond to a demand that we can't even remotely meet. Excuse me.
And the demand is probably there just because of the cost factor, right? Of like how much you actually need to spend at a typical garage versus how much you can save with going through the Lyft garage, depending on, you know, your life situation. Can you kind of just give us some numbers on what one of your services would be at the Lyft garage versus at a normal garage, just so put in perspective here?
So the Lyft garage charges $15 an hour for labor and then parts at cost. So whatever we pay for the parts is what the customer pays. And we often get discounted rates because we buy, in commercial volumes. So we're paying less than if that customer were to walk into a parts store themselves and buy it, they'll still pay less with us. Average market labor rate in the Twin Cities is about $110 an hour for labor. And then most places do anywhere from a 50 to a 200% markup on the parts. And so people end up paying at the Lyft about 28 to 30% of the cost that they would have paid for the same repair in a market rate shop. So it's a significant savings, you know, it's a $1,200 repair in a shop, you're going to pay about $300 with the Lyft. We are also aware that is even a lot of money for some folks. So we have some programs. We had a donor give us a significant amount of money earmarked for kind of emergency funding. So we use that and sort of apply it universally across the board for, you know, if you have a brake job, we're just going to cover brakes. So like real safety things, you know, steering and suspension, heat in the winter, we're just going to use that money to pay that part of your bill. So, you know, even with the lower rates, it almost always, your bill almost always goes down lower than that when we apply some of this emergency funding money to keep people's cars safe. So,
and when you think about it in like, let's say food terms, right? Someone that's living under the poverty line and you're saving $900 on a car repair, think about how much food now that family has to put on the table, how much longer it's going to last. Or now you have winter clothes that you can purchase and get through the winter. It just, it's so incredible on just savings in car repairs is going to trickle down to have a better life and other things too.
That's the vision. I mean, ultimately, it's ideally our work is about justice. It's about sort of leveling the economic playing field, if you will. And you know, there are loads of things, and we're not here today to talk about those, but loads of things that impact that are at play that result in people living in poverty, and that are often more about systems and wages than they are about personal choices or anything like that. And so I see, you know, our work is not only about helping people meet that immediate need, but ideally helping to kind of level the economic playing field a little bit to sort of, you know, balance things out on a greater scale.
What are some challenges that you've gone through over the years, and how did you overcome those challenges?
How long is this podcast? How many days do we have for me to tell to answer that question? I would say lots of expected challenges. You know, like how are we going to raise the money? You know, just even figuring out the particulars, like who qualifies and how much are we going to charge and how do we get a parts account? You know, like all those things. Of course, in the beginning. I would say the challenges that have been there since the beginning and that remain are these gray areas where it's, you know, on its surface, it seems simple. We'll just fix people's cars and we'll charge them less to do it. And then we'll raise money to offset it. But there gets to be this area of kind of, I guess, a moral gray area in some ways. So for example, something that happens regularly is we have a customer, you know, who has a car that has a lot of needs. The most pressing safety issue being like the brakes are almost non-existent. But we also hear a huge loud knocking from the engine that is ominous and that we know with our education and expertise portends, you know, an engine failure sometime in the not so distant future. We don't know if that's going to happen on the drive home or in 3 months, but we know that that engine has a limited life to it. We say, I can't in good conscience put brakes on your car when I'm not 100% confident you're even going to make it home without that engine going. And they say, I need brakes. I need to get to work tomorrow. I'm willing to take my chances. And I'm saying, if your engine dies on the way home and your $100 for those brakes is in our, you know, cash box, and now you're out $100 and you have no car. Like that is a really hard moral area for me to, like, to what degree do we participate in that knowing that we also don't know. I mean, we could fix those brakes and the car could last 3 months or 4 months, and that's great. That person's able to sort of kick the can down a low road a little bit while they figure out how to get a different car or some other alternative. But again, you know, if it doesn't, you know, if it dies tomorrow, then one, they're often mad, even though we've had the conversation, you know, why did you do that? And number two, that's a really hard place for my conscience to be like,
so what do you do? What's the solution? That is such a difficult spot to be in.
It is. And there, quite honestly, there are a lot of factors at play. And maybe it shouldn't be this way, but we have a lot of folks that we see that are also living in their car. So it's like, if it's also your home, That's going to make it even harder for me to say, no, we won't. Because now I'm not only, you know, not helping you with your transportation needs, I'm now essentially evicting you. And that, like that, that's too much to bear. So, you know, or we have a situation we're working with right now, kind of, the car is, you know, the engine needed to be replaced. Now the transmission needs to be replaced. The thing is a piece of crap. The woman is living in it and she still owes $3,000 on it.
Wow.
And so it's like, all right, we're just going to keep shoveling money and she doesn't have much money. So we're like kind of going above and beyond to try to find other community resources to help her pay for that. But it's like, this, there's no business investing in this car, but is, you know, you owe $3,000 on it. So it's like, all right, and you're living in it. And so it's like, those are the places where it's like, I never even thought about them in those ways, that we spend a lot of time and energy on, both in terms of trying to help people resolve the issue, but sort of navigating all the emotions around that, because people get mad if we say we're not going to do it. And I get that. Like, I came to you for help. I've been waiting for 2 months for an appointment and now you're saying you won't help me. You know, so to know when to draw that line, or, you know, so it just, those are the areas that are, that make the work emotionally challenging and complex. And I have no idea when we get it right and when we don't. I don't, you know, we just try to act in the best intention that we can with the information we have at the time and hope, you know, but that's hard. It's really hard.
You mentioned something about community resources, you know, whenever you get into that circumstance. And maybe there's another business owner listening in on this conversation right now, and they have a desire to give back, you know, in their business. Maybe it's in the mechanical world, or it could be in the pet world, or whatever it may be. What piece of advice would you give them in giving back within their businesses?
Thing I regularly say to people is, like, you don't have to start a nonprofit in order to give back to your community. So, like, you know, despite the CNN hero thing, I get real reluctant about that word, because the word hero, it sends a message that I'm not super comfortable with about our capabilities in our community. And once we start saying certain people are heroes, or, you know, up on a pedestal, or that implies that they have something I don't. You know, and so then we start thinking, I can't do it because I don't have that, whatever it is to be a hero or a saint or an angel or a, it allows us to sort of take the responsibility off ourselves for taking care of each other if we think that only a certain kind of people can do that or are capable of doing that. And so it's, that is not the message I want people to hear, because it's like, you can do whatever you can with what you have at that moment. And so if you're a garage owner, like, would it work in your books to call up your local Salvation Army and say, I can take one car a week and I can charge $15 an hour for the labor and the parts at cost. And can you, you know, just refer people to me and I'll do the car repair. Like, that's many shops, I think, especially chains or other things, can certainly handle that capacity. I think, especially if we aren't asking them to do the screening and the this and the that and take the phone calls. It's like, yep, once a week, the Salvation Army is gonna, you know, send me a person whose car I'm gonna fix, or whose cat I'm gonna spay, or whose, you know, fill in the blank, depending on your business. It's like, there are loads of ways. And that's actually some of my vision for the next phase of the Lift, is not necessarily to open more Lift garages, but to engage on East Lake Street, where we are in Minneapolis, to my east, for the next mile and a half or so, there's 6 other shops. And to my west and the other mile, there's about 5 other shops. So I just have this vision. What if we got 10 shops to agree to those terms? We'll send you the people. You take one a week. 10 shops do that, charge the same rates we charge. There's 500 appointments we've created in our community at the same rates that the Lift is charging. So I think there is a big capacity for people to kind of do a small part and make a huge impact. As is often the case with stuff in community, it does require a lot of people to agree to it to have the impact, but that's, you know, so I'm trying to think those ways of how do we engage the community in solving this problem, because quite honestly, I'm not convinced that even having three lift garages would meet the need in our community. So we've got to be thinking about ways to do this differently in addition to what we're doing at the lift.
Yeah, I absolutely love that vision. I mean, imagine that. That's one street that you're talking about in your town. That's one street. Imagine the impact in every major city if they just said, hey, I'll do one. I mean, that would be amazing. You know, what you're doing, Crystal, and I absolutely love it. And I know you're helping so many people. And I would love to end this with, you know, a story of someone that you've impacted, maybe that you could share with us.
Yeah, one of my favorite stories is a woman named Alicia. And Alicia was working at a social service agency, but making not enough money. I mean, she was making low enough that she qualified for our services. And Alicia had an opportunity within that agency to move up. They loved her there. They loved her skills. They loved, you know, her work ethic. They loved all those things. So they wanted her to move into more like a case manager position, which paid significantly more than what she was doing, but it required a car. So she managed to work with her church, who somebody donated a car to her, but it was in pretty crappy shape. So she came to see us several times, and we got the car working really, really well. And then one day Alicia showed up kind of unexpectedly and out of the blue and didn't have an appointment. And I said, what brings you by? And she said, I just came to tell you, I don't qualify anymore. You won't be seeing me again. I make too much money. I just wanted to say thank you. And that was probably 3 years ago, and we haven't seen or heard from her since. And I only can trust and hope that her life has taken on the trajectory that we want to be able to support. And I was so grateful that she stopped by, so we knew how that story ended. We don't often get to have the loop closed for us. You know, again, in our dream world, we fix somebody's car and then we don't hear from them not because we don't want to see them again, but because maybe they have moved into a different position in their life that they don't need our services anymore. So that's one of my favorite stories, because it's like that right there, that's the hope.
That's it.
But if you're in a situation, maybe you've got a disability or you've got something else where it's like, you're always going to live on the financial edge because of your physical limitations or whatever other circumstance in your life. And there's not a hope of getting a higher paying job or like that. That's okay too. We're going to be here. You know, we don't limit. You can't, you know, it's not like, oh, you can just come once. It's like, you got limited financial means and you're driving a crappy car. That thing's going to break down about every 3 months. I promise. You know, so let's, you know, so we want to be there to keep people's lives stable as much as we can. So it's not always about, you know, moving up economically, even though that's really fun to see when that happens. But it is also about just providing a level of security and stabilization in people's lives.
That's amazing. Awesome. Kathy, for our listeners who want to learn more about the Lift Garage and you, how can they get in touch with you and your organization, social media handles, all that good stuff?
Sure. Our website is the most comprehensive, www.theliftgarage, and that is liftgarage.org. We are also on Instagram, Twitter, and Facebook at The Lift Garage. There's lots of great information about how our program works. There's information on our website about interested in starting your own shop, here are questions you should ask yourself. So for folks who are wanting to think about doing this in their communities, we try to provide some support and information that way too. So, and of course, I would not be good at my job if I didn't put in a plug for raising money. We are able to charge $15 an hour because the community through foundations and individual giving, churches, they pay the other 70% of what it costs to run the garage. The money we take in repairs pays about 25 to 30% of our overhead. We have to fundraise the rest, which is right now at our size, about $1 million a year. We can't do this without you all in the community, our partners. Is my favorite thing in the world when I hear donors and other folks talk about the lift in the first person. At the lift, we fix, because that's right. We do it together. We do our part. We got the wrenches in our hands here. Sister Judy gives us $5 a month, and, you know, the person who provided the emergency fund money and all that, like, we can't do our wrench part without you doing your part. And, you know, it's a, like everything in life, it's better in community. And we can't do it without folks partnering with us. So you can also find information about how to donate to the Lift Garage on our website.
So everyone listening, you heard it. There might be Lift Garage pop-ups all over the U.S. after this podcast. Next time you go visit your mechanic, make sure you refer this podcast to him or her and let them know what all the good things that she's doing, you know, that. So we want to be a part of it. Also, just a random idea. I have this envision of you partnering with like a nonprofit or someone that collects like donated cars or something. So when you get into those like really difficult times, you know, you can just say, hey, I think I know somebody that could help you. We can't fix your car right here, but I think I have a solution, you know, and then it just kind of happens. It spirals and it's all good work being done. So that was random. I just want to throw that in there. But thank you again, Kathy, for all your time. We really do appreciate it. Tim and I enjoyed speaking with you today and excited to see what the future is going to hold for the Lift Garage.
Wonderful. Thank you all again for what you're doing, for bringing some joy to the world through your work. Super grateful. And I'm super grateful again for the opportunity. So thanks for your time.
Thank you so much for listening to the Connect Kindness podcast. If you enjoyed this episode, please share it on Facebook, Twitter, and Instagram @ShareGiveDo. And please remember, the world is changed by your example, not by your opinion.